Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. The latest Marquette University Law School poll shows an electorate unsure of what they think of challengers to the two state's two biggest races for governor and U.S. Senate. Incumbents seem to have an edge a month out from the primaries, except Donald Trump. His numbers are down, but he's not on the ballot. Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy. He joins us today in studio. Professor Franklin, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So let's start with this Democratic primary for governor. We're about a month out from the race. About 38% of voters today say they still do not know which of the eight candidates they would support for the nomination. This hasn't really changed much from June, has it?
Not much. And for the seven that constitute the PAC, it hasn't changed at all. Mm. They're all in single digits, below 10, and haven't really seen a big surge for anyone. The person who has steadily improved is Tony Evers. In our March survey, he was at 18% support, then at 25 in June, and now at 31 now.
Okay.
So you see a clear front runner in this case who's been steadily improving his position as well as opening up a wide gap with the field. But that 38% undecided,
right,
I think, is the big number.
So is it because people know who Tony Evers is, that he's a name that they recognize from before and they don't necessarily recognize other names?
He's had the advantage of running successfully statewide for school superintendent three times. And while that's a technically nonpartisan position and spring elections are low turnout races,
right,
he is the only one that has won a statewide election that's on the ballot. And so that name familiarity plays a role, but not to overstate it, because only about 60% say they don't know enough about Evers to say whether they have a favorable or unfavorable view of him.
Mm.
But his advantage is it's 75 to 85% for most of the rest of the field. So there are some name advantages for Evers. The steady build may show party support or organizational support. The thing that happens when you have such a large field of relatively unknown candidates is that it's very hard to break out of that field, and we see that for the seven that aren't named Evers. But historically, occasionally, in big fields like this, one person has something happen that helps them stand out.
Okay.
And then, since this is a party primary, other Democrats sort of look, and there's not a whole lot of difference among this pack. So if one stands out, you can see a quick change of support. Now, that hasn't happened so far. I think it's fair to say Evers is the clear front runner, but with 38 undecided and the rest spread among these seven, the possibility for sudden, sharp change between now and the primary is very real.
So what needs to happen, or what historically has happened, to make somebody stand out who's kind of back in the pack?
Well, typically we've seen it in, like, presidential elections where a front runner dominates, but then a member of the pack wins Iowa or wins New Hampshire, or even just comes close in one of those contests. And then everybody that's not already on board for the front runner finds that person broadly acceptable. They're within the same party, and so they flock to them. See, that doesn't happen when it's a Democrat versus a Republican, because then the other guy's not broadly acceptable. But within the party, these kinds of dynamics can happen.
But is there any sort of marker that's going to happen before August 14th?
I think we might have seen that marker already, and it didn't appear. In other words, from the Democratic convention in early June till now, we've had two chances to see a candidate begin to break out, and we haven't seen that happen. But none of them have waged advertising campaigns. None of them have been super prominent in the news during this period. And that reflects the constraints of campaign resources, the amount of money they've been able to raise. And frankly, it's also an effect of our now August primaries, when people are away from their house on vacation over the summer, or they're simply enjoying themselves. It's not surprising that people tune in late to the primaries. But the consequence is, in both parties, we have a third and more of undecided voters.
You know, I've been seeing candidates who are putting out these videos, these really, really well done life story videos that charge people up. I haven't seen any candidates here in Wisconsin doing that. Is there a possibility that somebody may break out with something like that?
I think it's conceivable. We have seen videos, online advertising, work for some candidates, some here in the state. But they've gotten buzz and they've gotten attention within either party. But what they haven't done is cross over from the folks that obsessively follow politics and are very engaged all the time to break over into the mass of voters who are only occasionally excited and focused on politics.
We are talking to Charles Franklin about the Marquette University Law School poll. He runs this poll. He's the guy behind the poll that we always hear about. It's kind of a murky picture of voters right now in the summer of 2018. So let's talk about this Democratic gubernatorial race. 38% say they don't know who they're going to be voting for. 51% of people likely to vote in the Democratic primary have no opinion of the candidates. So that suggests that 13% of people intend to vote for candidates that they have no opinion about. I don't understand this.
Yeah. Partly it's because the way we ask the "do you have an opinion about this person" deliberately doesn't give a cue as to who that person is. So we simply ask, do you have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of Kel DeRoy's, or haven't you heard enough to have an opinion of her?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we don't say Kel DeRoy's, who's a Madison former legislator who's running for governor.
Right.
Because we want to know whether people really recognize that name. But by the time we get to the vote question, we're saying, who of the following people will you vote for in the Democratic primary? So everybody at that point knows who they are. And there's a difference between picking out a name when you're just asked about it cold the way we do,
mm-hmm,
versus choosing a name from a list that you know are all Democratic candidates. So that's where the extra comes from. It doesn't mean that people are well informed about that list. More so than they are at recognizing the name in the first place, though.
What it tells me is maybe there are people who are just saying, I'm voting Democratic. I don't care who the nominee is. I'm voting Democratic.
We've certainly saw that not in this poll, but in the June poll, when we matched each of the then 10 Democrats against Governor Walker and both of the Republicans against Tammy Baldwin. There's relatively little variation in the vote split, because essentially most people are responding to this incumbent that I know something about compared to this Democrat that I may, or Republican that, mm-hmm, I may, or challenger that I may or may not know anything about, but I know they're not that incumbent.
Let me ask you about this August primary. When was the primary? You got to know I'm new here, right?
Exactly.
So when was the primary and what's the backstory on this?
It's August 14th is the date of the primary, but until a few years ago, our primaries were in the fall, in September.
Mm.
They got moved back because of changes in federal law about allowing enough time for overseas voters to receive a ballot following the primary, and that was pretty constrained with our later primary. But in the past, having it in September meant that you at least got past the end of summer, beginning of school, past Labor Day, the traditional beginning of campaigns. So we've been doing this for a number of years, several years now, but it is still a little bit early in the year, sticking it in the end of summer as opposed to early fall.
So this lack of a strong opinion about the candidates, do you think it's going to hurt either Democratic candidates or even the two Republican candidates for U.S. Senate?
Well, all of them are about equally unknown. It ranges from 60 to 95% that don't know, but the two Republican candidates are at 69 and 66% mm-hmm. unknown. So it's really generic to the non-incumbent candidates right now that they're not well known. I think in this last 4 weeks, we will see a rising amount of news coverage of the campaigns. We'll see a rising amount of advertising within the budgets that the campaigns have. And we'll see voters beginning to tune in and start to pay attention, as voters do. It's just going to be a fairly compressed 4 weeks.
When is your next poll?
It's in August, after the primary.
After
we want to see
primary.
Who the real November candidates are, and then we'll ask about them.
We are talking to Charles Franklin about the Marquette University Law School poll that came out yesterday with some murky numbers if you are a challenger. And next, we're going to talk a little, dig a little deeper into this poll. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Two Democratic gubernatorial candidates dropped out of the race last month. They hadn't seen much support in the Marquette University Law School poll. Will we see more candidates end their campaigns this month after yesterday's poll? In the latest poll, only school superintendent Tony Evers is in double digits among likely primary voters. Democrats, are you planning to vote? Have you made up your mind about the candidates for governor? Are there just too many? Republicans, have you decided between the two candidates for U.S. Senate? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're sitting here with Charles Franklin, who is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll. Director Franklin, we're talking about people dropping out. Two people dropped out of the race after you gave them the bad news last month. Everybody except Evers is still in single digits. Are we likely to see people drop out now?
I think it's unlikely at this point, at least a formal dropout. We've only got four weeks to go. The campaigns have built up whatever money they have to close out the rest of the race. And as I was saying earlier, this is a case where Evers has a very clear advantage, but the possibility that you catch fire is real. For some, it may be the possibility that you're setting up a future race as well, and closing strong could be helpful for that. But I think the dropouts we saw a month ago, I think, reflected with 8 weeks to go and no traction and fundraising deadlines coming up, people chose not to move on with their race. Now, having not responded to single digits that everybody except Evers were in last time, there's very little reason I can see to drop out now, though you could imagine winding down your campaign, especially if you start running out of money.
So speaking of money, Kelda Royce, who is a state rep, had the most fundraising thus far. She did have a video that kind of broke out, her breastfeeding video, and yet she's still around 3%. Is this surprising to you?
It is a bit surprising to me in the sense that that video got a lot of buzz, especially in progressive circles and Democratic circles. She's been endorsed by Emily's List, a national group that supports progressive women candidates. And she won the straw poll at the Democratic Convention, which is an unofficial poll, but it is pretty widely watched. So I had expected to see her break out notably in the June poll, and yet she didn't. And so I think that reflects the gap that those of us that do politics more or less professionally have a hard time appreciating, that we're watching these candidates perform and do better than expected or worse than expected. And we just have a hard time appreciating that for most people, they're paying attention to other things, other interests, other concerns.
Other things going on in the world, perhaps. It's not like it's a boring world we live in right now.
It really is. And not everyone is a professional politics watcher.
That is true. I have trouble believing that sometimes. Let's talk about the U.S. Senate race. Tammy Baldwin obviously is running unopposed in her primary, but there are two challengers for the Republican side. Who do you think is going to come out on top there?
Sure. Well, here we've seen sort of the opposite of the Democratic side, where a front runner has expanded the lead. Here, the race was a 9-point difference, with Kevin Nicholson leading by 9 back in March. In June, that was a five-point lead. Mm. And today, it's Leo Vukmir with a 2-point edge, 34 to 32. Now, there's a 7-point margin of error, so that 2-point difference is completely inside the margin of error. Mm-hmm. But you can see the trend over these months of a tightening race. There, too, 30% are undecided. So it'd be, I think, entirely fair to call the Republican Senate race a clear toss-up, mm-hmm. with two now evenly matched candidates, both with substantial resources and outside groups supporting them. That contrasts with the Democratic gubernatorial primary, where there's a clear front runner, but still the potential for someone to break out. In this Republican Senate race, we have a clear toss-up election.
We are talking with Charles Franklin about his poll, the Marquette University Law School poll. And we are taking your calls also, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Clarence from Watertown, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good morning. First, I'd like to say I really enjoy Professor Franklin's presentation. He's always right down the middle on all the issues and the way he presents the polls. Second of all, as a definite Republican voter, I'm kind of running into Kevin Nicholson overload. The different radio stations I listen to during the day, I just marvel at the amount of money that's being put forth on his behalf, and I just, it's kind of turning me off to the candidate.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Thank you very much, Clarence. So the more money you put in might actually backfire because you're kind of annoying people coming into their living rooms every day.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for the comments. I appreciate that. But it is an interesting irony that because largely it's been outside groups spending money on the Republican primary race, it actually has had more advertising, especially in particular markets of, for example, radio or conservative talk radio. And so the overload is sort of interesting. Normally we think any of that advertising is good at boosting someone's name recognition. But maybe there is a point of too many returns, if you will.
yes, there is. We got Nate from Milwaukee. Nate, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Especially when I read the articles about how much money Scott Walker's been getting and has, and which, by the way, I think is the most innocent explanation for why he'd be standing between a Russian spy and a Russian banker with mob ties in that photo, is that he wanted money from them, is that what Democrat could potentially inspire people to vote for him when having to face that head on? And I noticed this poll didn't have a head-to-head comparison with Walker. But the last one did. And in that one, I think that both Mitchell and McCabe ran better head-to-head against Walker than Tony Evers. So this wide lead of Tony Evers makes me wonder if a lot of Democratic voters are not thinking strategically when they're looking at the primary.
Interesting question. Thank you for that, Nate.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question about what message will a challenger to Walker be able to bring that hasn't already been tried in the three previous gubernatorial races that Walker's won, counting the recall election? And I'm listening carefully as well to the messages that the Democratic candidates are using to provide criticism of Walker that may bite in a different way than the things that have been tried in the past. I think message matters and candidate matters, and the trouble is finding the right combination of a candidate who has that mysterious connection with voters, that's personality and approach, and the right messages that can be used to effectively challenge a now long-term incumbent. I think on the money side, I don't think anybody expects a Democratic candidate to be able to match the financial resources that Governor Walker has amassed. But the good news for Democrats, at least, is that historically, a challenger doesn't need to outspend the incumbent to win, but a challenger needs enough resources to wage a credible campaign, to be visible and have the things campaigns need to do. That same would apply in the Baldwin case, where Tammy Baldwin has a very strong war chest, and the Republican candidates wouldn't necessarily need to outspend her, but would need to have the resources to wage a credible campaign. But message and candidate matters a whole lot.
You know, we had that caller a minute ago who talked about Nicholson's ads being a little too much. He released another one last night. Was this strategic to the poll, you think?
I'd be surprised if it's linked. I think it's simply a matter of we're 4 weeks out, almost exactly, with yesterday. It's time to start doing that advertising and get out front.
So one of the things that struck me about this poll is that it shows this state to be incredibly partisan. There, anything that you ask Republicans to support, Republican, like 94% of Republicans support it, and Democrats and independents kind of go the other way. My question is, whenever I've talked to people about those numbers, I've been told, well, a lot of independents used to be Republicans. And yet I looked at the Gallup poll, the month to month, and I'm not really seeing more or less Republicans or more or less independents. Right. What are you seeing here?
Yeah, this is an active area of discussion in political science, as well as pundit and and campaign analysts. There's an argument that has been advanced, and it's a serious argument, that the folks within the Republican Party that did not support Donald Trump and don't like him now have become more likely to call themselves independents rather than Republicans. And that the result of that is to make the party divide look bigger, because those who haven't left the GOP are hardcore Trump supporters, and that holds up his approval rating, which runs in the upper 80s. It was 86%, 87% in our poll yesterday that approve of the job he's doing among Republicans. However, I have to pour some cold water on that. I think it's, to me, to my eye of looking at the data, it's been exaggerated. In national polling, I don't see a decline in the percentage of people that identify with the GOP. Maybe it's down 1 or 2% total, but it's pretty modest. And likewise, I'm not seeing substantial increases in the Democratic side. Now, what we do historically see is, between elections, a little bit of rise of independents and a little bit of decline in partisans. But that's enough to account for the 1 or 2%. The research that has talked to the same voters from 2015 to 16 to now, I think 17 is the last time that somebody did this, finds actually that to the extent there's been switching between the parties, it's almost exactly equal between Republicans becoming independent or Democrat and Democrats becoming independent or Republican. So my reading of the data is that the decline of Republican identification is much exaggerated. But let's be clear, there are respectable folks doing research on this that see the glass a little differently than I do.
We shall see. You also asked in this poll, interestingly enough, about Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Why did you include him in this poll, and what did you find?
Well, we were lucky in the sense that the president announced exactly when he was going to put forth the nomination, which just happened to be 2 days before we started interviewing. We have had, of course, two previous vacancies on the court in the last couple of years. And so we've asked about those nominations. It was the perfect opportunity to ask about Kavanaugh to capture first impressions of him. The hearings for his nomination will run into the fall. But here we've got just first impressions. And what we find is not real surprising. 50% of voters have not heard enough about him to have an opinion. Of those who have, it's a fairly even split, about 27, 23, I believe, favorable or unfavorable. So, you know, it's early first impressions. And again, in the partisan side, Republicans much more positive, Democrats much more skeptical of him.
We are talking about the latest Marquette University Law School poll with Charles Franklin, who puts the poll together. And we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You also asked people about immigration. What specifically were you looking for here?
Here, we have asked a lot of detailed questions about immigration in the past. But since our June poll, we've had the family separation mm-hmm. issue on the border. President Trump has changed policies there, but families have not been easily reunited.
Yeah, there's
and
still
so
families
so
that are not reunited.
It's a continuing issue. And, mm-hmm. of course, strong criticism of immigrants and non-legal entries into the country has been core of Trump's policy. So we just tried to ask it as a straightforward, do you approve or disapprove of the way Donald Trump is handling immigration? And we found 40% approved and 53% disapproved. That's only a little bit different from the 42-50 overall job approval. And I think it's striking that for such a controversial issue that has largely looked like chaos on the border, a policy that's been changing, not to mention the simple fact of taking children away from their parents, mm-hmm. That his immigration approval is hardly different from the overall. The one thing that does stand out is 86% of Republicans approve of Trump overall. 74% approved of him on immigration. So maybe there's a 12-point penalty there among Republicans who are not thrilled with the border policy right now. Surprisingly, it's independents who actually are higher in both approval and disapproval of immigration than they are overall. And I think that shows independents who are not partisan, not mm-hmm. all that terribly politically active, are responding, but they're responding both positively and negatively on the immigration issue. That sort of touches on Trump's strength to be able to use a super controversial issue to actually rally a bit of support among these independents, even though he pays a price in disapproval
right.
as well.
So how does this affect the state races?
Well, I think the question is whether Trump's policies broadly or immigration particularly will be a part of the campaign. I think we have seen on the Senate side, both Republican candidates embrace Trump, largely support his Helsinki conference or summit. Mm-hmm. And so they've really embraced
the summit with
Donald
Putin.
Trump, with Putin.
Putin, where he said he believed Putin and not our intelligence community.
Exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, and there's some shading of details of what they're supporting, but they've embraced the president on this. They've also embraced him on the border wall, on immigration issues and so on, a sharp contrast with Tammy Baldwin. So as a national federal issue, we would expect that to come up in the Senate race. The governor's race, probably less so. Governor Walker, in fact, has repeatedly declined to answer questions about it, saying that's a federal issue and not a state issue. Now, a Democrat might push that.
Might, and Governor Walker might be drawn into this because of the whole Russian thing now that he's been named with. We're talking with Charles Franklin. He's the director of the Marquette University Law School poll. Tomorrow, and in a moment, we're going to dig into more state issues with this poll and take your calls. It's The Morning Show. We're talking about the Marquette Law School University poll today. It came out yesterday, and the man who drives that poll is sitting here with us in studio. Charles Franklin is taking your calls and talking to me. Right now we've got Christine from Eau Claire. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I wanted to say that I am very impressed with Kathleen Vino. I think that because she has a rural connection and as the current center, she really has the pulse of what's happening in Madison, but also in our rural areas, which need a lot of attention. And I, because of her experience in Madison and the alternative budgets that she's written, she could really punch holes in what some of the spin that Scott Walker will use on the campaign trail. So thanks for having me.
Thanks for calling in, Christine. So Kathleen Vinaud, I've seen a lot of yard signs and bumper stickers and what have you in Madison, but she does have a bit of a rural connection.
She definitely does, and that has been one of the strong talking points of her campaign and actually her legislative career, of the need for Democrats to focus on regions outside of the South and Southeast, the Madison, Milwaukee, Janesville area, which are strong Democratic areas. And she has, in fact, won rural areas, her Senate, state Senate district. She's at 6% in this latest poll. That ties her with Malin Mitchell for second place.
Okay. And she's so moved up right here.
A shade up. She's been 5-5-6,
okay,
so it's
fine.
Not really much of a move. But the point is, she does have some support there, at least equal to her competitors back in the pack. But she, like all the others that are in that under 10% range, have to find a way to attract the attention and support of other Democrats. And the question is, what will that look like? How will it happen? Will it happen for one of them?
We are talking about the Marquette University Law School poll, which asked questions about state races and also asked questions about national races. It came out yesterday, and voters are looking pretty indecisive here in Wisconsin. I think that's the best thing I can say. We are also taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's talk about trade, Charles. You asked some questions specifically about Harley-Davidson and their motivations for moving jobs. What did you find out?
Well, here the situation was that President Trump imposed tariffs. The European Union responded with tariffs of their own on, among other things, Harley-Davidson motorcycles. Harley-Davidson then announced that it was going to move some production from the U.S. in order to avoid those European tariffs. And then the president on Twitter and elsewhere criticized Harley for that move and claimed that it wasn't because of the tariffs. It was something Harley was doing for other reasons. So we asked the question, do you think Harley moved these jobs because of the tariff increases, or would these jobs have been moved regardless of the tariffs? And that's sort of the way that the president had lined up the criticism. What we found was 37% said it was because of the tariffs, but 47% said the jobs would have moved anyway, and a bit over 20% said they really didn't know. And I think this is striking. On the one hand, you again get a big partisan split, with Republicans, two-thirds, 67%, deny that it was tariffs, say it would have happened anyway. With Democrats, it's 56% say it was because of the tariffs, but it's still 31% that say the jobs would have moved anyway.
Right.
I think it reflects one thing that really is important, and that's the broad sense that's developed over 20 years that manufacturing jobs frequently get moved out of the U.S., and those didn't have anything to do with tariffs. And so there's a strong question about whether this is really tariff-related or not.
Okay, so it may not be tariff-related, or people may not think it's tariff-related, but Trump was elected in part to stop manufacturers from leaving the U.S., and clearly he has not stopped Harley from doing that. Don't people react to that?
Well, I think that's the question, is who do you blame in this situation? Republicans are only 21% were willing to say Harley's decision was tariff-related. Because to say that would be to say maybe this trade war is not as easy to win as it looks. But I think there had been an impression that Harley was a perfect example of a state industry being harmed by the president's policies. And these numbers show that that's not necessarily true. A plurality are not blaming the tariffs for the job loss, but are instead pointing to the broader trend of jobs being moved overseas.
We have time for one quick call. Gene from Appleton. Gene, welcome to the program.
Yes, I'll make it quick. I think I'm going to be a pragmatist and vote for Tony Evers, although he is not my preferred candidate. I've reached the point that I feel that the only choice we have is going to be the person who can beat Scott Walker, and that looks like Tony Evers. I don't have anything against Tony, but the platforms of a couple of other people in the race appeal to me more, but they just haven't moved in the polls, and I can't see that changing between now and the primary.
Thank you very much, Gene. So are you hearing this a lot from people?
We're hearing that, and I also think it reflects the dilemma of any party in the decision to nominate your ideal candidate versus nominate the candidate that, on pragmatic grounds, just as Gene phrased it, you think is going to be the stronger candidate, even if they don't fit perfectly with you. We'll see a little bit of that on the Republican side for the Senate as well. It's not prominent yet, but at some point Republicans will ask themselves which of these two candidates is better against Tammy Baldwin. But I do think this is an issue that confronts partisans of all stripes when it comes to a front runner versus the pack. And yes, the pack may have some people I like better.
We have been talking to Charles Franklin. He's the director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy. He's the co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. He's been with us and hopefully will come back with us next month after the primary and after you do your next poll.
Certainly.
Okay, fine. I just roped him into that. Thanks for being here, Charles.
Thank you.
Now we're going to turn our coverage of the aftermath of flooding and heavy rains in northern Wisconsin. It's been a month since floods caused around $11 million in damage to roads and public infrastructure in northern Wisconsin. This week, officials with the Federal Emergency Management Agency were getting a closer look at washed out roads and whether the region will qualify for federal disaster declaration. As Daniel Kading reports, that declaration is tied to money that can help the region recover.
A caravan of cars is driving down a stretch of road in Bayfield County. Getting out of his car, Troy Christensen with FEMA says it was good a road engineer told him to go slow.
I'm glad he mentioned not to go too fast, because from a distance it just looks like a big area of shade.
What looks like a shadow is actually a huge gaping hole where the road is missing.
So this is what we call a significant total road washout.
That's Catherine Warren, a public assistance specialist with FEMA. She's part of a team doing damage assessments in the county. Warren says they visit sites like this to gauge how much repairs might cost.
So at this site, they'll have to put the culvert back in and put a lot of big rocks on top of it to hold it in place, hopefully, during the next storm.
After a walk around, the team heads out to drive to a similar site, not far from this one. The roads turn from gravel to blacktop, back to gravel again. It's a temporary fix that towns have been using until they can repair washed-out roads. When the team arrives, Mason road worker Mark Lake points out a 60-foot drain pipe mangled in pieces among the trees. He says it's been long, hot days since the flooding.
We've worked on other roads, getting them open. But there are still some people that have to drive, you know, 4 or 5 miles out of the way to get to an open road.
Lake says the town has 56 areas where roads are damaged or washed out. So far, they've been able to make 10 passable and hope to finish this one by the end of the week. He says the rest will take time and money.
You look at the money that's involved to fix this stuff, and you're looking at 3, maybe 4 times the amount of money that the township has for the entire budget. Not just the roads budget, everything.
That's why county and town officials in northern Wisconsin are hoping for a federal disaster declaration. It would mean access to more money to fix roads and public infrastructure. But that won't help close to 80 homes and businesses damaged by flooding. There would have to be about six times that many damaged for individuals to qualify for federal aid. Chester Brower of Delta has been relying on his neighbors to help him clear out mounds of sand that flooded his home.
Where the house was, there was just nothing but water. The whole, as far as you could see, there was water. Because there was like a river going right through where my home was and down the ditch, down to the town hall, and it washed out the road, just like a whole lane it took out.
He says the wall of water and sand moved his house 3 inches and buried two trucks.
Every day is a fresh adventure. I have to spend some time away, otherwise I'd be digging all the time. But that's my goal. I want to be back in my home before the winter.
Friends, neighbors, and strangers have pitched in to help. Cars are lined up and down the road by hides on Busky Bay and Iron River. Inside the restaurant, people are eating spaghetti and buying raffle tickets. Helen Hyde and her husband Don own the restaurant and resort. Stepping outside, Hyde says people and businesses from around the region chipped in to raise money for Brower.
They all came together and donated amazing prizes and gifts and paintings and you name it.
Brower says it definitely lightens the load.
Everybody makes it easier. I always think there's good in people. I'm that glass is half full guy, you know, can't give up.
He says there's nothing to do but keep going. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're going to keep watching what's going on in northern Wisconsin here at WPR. We're also going to keep talking about roads and road infrastructure. Lots of people have called in about that. And Charles Franklin, we didn't get to this, but Charles Franklin asked a question about roads. And according to his poll, a lot of people are concerned about the state of roads all across the state. So we will keep following this and following the flooding in northern Wisconsin, rebuilding. Thank you, Danielle. You can follow our continued coverage of this at WPR.org. I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show, and you are listening to the Ideas Network.